Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native American wildlife experts are concerned about Wisconsin's plan to begin a hunting and trapping season for gray wolves. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
The federal government took the wolf off the endangered species list in the western Great Lakes region 2 months ago after a long, slow comeback in the wolf population. State lawmakers in Minnesota and Wisconsin quickly introduced wolf hunting bills, and the Wisconsin measure has already been passed. Peter David is a biologist with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, or GLIFWIC. He says tribes were not consulted about the Wisconsin bill.
And it's a disservice certainly to the tribes. It's a disservice, I think, to a lot of the other groups that have been working towards wolf restoration in the state.
David says not only do many tribes live close to wolf habitat in northern Wisconsin, but many Ojibwe tribal members regard the wolf as a sacred animal.
It is the understanding among the Ojibwe that their fate is really intertwined with that of the wolves. And as the wolf goes, so will the people.
If Wisconsin's governor signs the wolf hunt bill into law, the State Department of Natural Resources will draft administrative rules to cover a hunting and trapping season beginning this fall. Department official Kurt Thede promises meetings with the GLIFWIC agency.
We have let GLIFWIC know that we will be reaching out to them through a consultation, you know, government to government.
One key issue of debate may be how many of Wisconsin's roughly 800 wolves could be killed during the hunting season. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
The Tanana Chiefs Conference hosted its 50th annual meeting this week in Fairbanks, Alaska. Among the topics addressed were rural energy and two proposed natural gas pipeline projects in the state. Emily Schwing has more.
The Tanana Chiefs Conference serves more than 10,000 Alaskan Natives. As president of TCC, Jerry Isaac says he was speaking for 42 villages across the state when he voiced his concerns about cultural resource preservation and environmental impacts associated with two proposed natural gas pipeline projects.
Every time there's something like this, they want to get it to market with as least participation from the impacted peoples and area, meaning me and the people I represent.
Frank Richards is the deputy federal coordinator with Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects. Richards says the process required by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission accounts for Isaac's concerns.
There are specific concerns about cultural resources, and that's why the subsistence surveys and the health impact analysis are being undertaken by the Departments of Fish and Game and Health and Human Services.
Richards is working on a project that would carry natural gas from Alaska's North Slope through Canada. The state is also working on a standalone pipeline. Jerry Isaac says he hasn't seen enough effort to form meaningful partnerships from either project.
The habitual way of handling Native Americans is the least you inform them, the least you have to do with them, the better you are as a developer. We want to participate. We want to partner. We want to cooperate. They don't approach us on the same par level as we've been trying to approach them.
Both projects are proposed for completion by 2020, with projected costs ranging from $7.5 to $40 billion. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing for National Native News.
On this day in 2011, Navajo code talker Lloyd Oliver passed away. The 88-year-old was from Shiprock, New Mexico. He joined the Marines in 1942 and was one of the original 29 Navajo men who created an unbreakable code in their traditional language. The code was used to transmit messages in the Pacific Theater during World War II. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Kawanic is accepting reservations for the 17th Annual Alaska Native Art Auction. Proceeds benefit KNBA and Native Public Radio programming. Visit knba.org or call 907-793-3528 for reservations.
Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC, CLIC, GIVE when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after three. You're in tune with KTOO News. This is Pat Moore hosting today for Juneau Afternoon. With me in the studio is Art Roach from several different places, I guess, representing partially UAS, but really Perseverance Theater.
That's
right. And you're talking about an upcoming thing called the Landmarks Festival, right?
That's right. It's a week-long festival of readings and followed by a panel discussion on Friday at UAS as part of the Sound and Motion series at Egan Lecture Hall.
So what are we going to see and hear and do?
Well, from Monday through Thursday, there are four different plays, all by writers of color, that deal with some common themes. And we chose Landmarks because one of the common themes has to do with land and who gets to decide who lives where, things like that. If you've seen A Raisin in the Sun, the storyline revolves around an African-American family living in the ghetto who have a windfall, and they have to decide. The family dynamic revolves around deciding what to do with the money. And their decision is to move out of the ghetto and buy a home. And the home they can afford is in an all-white neighborhood. So those issues sort of come up, too. And that's really the challenge that the family has to overcome, is whether they have the courage to make that move into this all-white neighborhood and take what will come with that in 1951.
Sort of beyond guess who's coming to dinner, guess who's coming to the neighborhood.
Yeah. It's a pretty great story, classic American story.
So what are the other plays that we'll see?
It's a great lineup. On Monday the 19th, Ishmael Hope's new play that we've been working on for a year or so now, which is called The Defenders of Alaska Native Country. There'll be some kind of a sneak peek of that, probably a reading of the current version of the script. We've been working with Ishmael for a year or so on this. It tells the story of William Paul, the Alaska Native Brotherhood, and the civil rights struggle followed by the land claim struggle here in southeast Alaska. It's an amazing untold story. And there's some really interesting parallels between the civil rights movement in southeast Alaska and the African-American civil rights movement. So there are these resonances between A Raisin in the Sun and this story that I think are pretty amazing.
Perseverance has done a number of plays which are in a genre that I think is real popular in England right now, which is getting to some public event that's known and then using words that are real rather than words that are written by a playwright. Is that the nature of Ishmael Hope's piece here?
We don't know entirely. There is some material that is archival. And,
it's kind of like documentary on stage sort of thing. I think it has a name, but I can't remember what the buzzword for it is.
Documentary, docudrama is a little derogatory.
Yeah, that's not the word I've heard used. There was a story today, as a matter of fact, on The World, 12 o'clock newscast, I think, about a play that's going to be performed in Scotland next week about an event that happened last week. And so they're, it's not last week, it's the last month or two, it's the Murdoch scandal with the wiretapping.
Yeah.
They're actually bringing in words from the interviews of journalists.
Yes.
As the thing, and they're going to, as I understand it, they're going to put it on in a journalistic setting, in a newsroom.
Oh, that's great.
So it's moving toward that. And you've been playing with that kind of thing.
Our first play was Oral History here. Is talking to people who remembered the mining days, pure gold, and then taking the transcripts of that material and turning it into a drama.
Right.
So, yeah. And this, the Defenders of Alaska Native Country, there's rich, rich material that's in the form of transcripts or recordings of the characters in the play. It includes, you know, Andrew Hope and Elizabeth Paratovich and Roy Paratovich, et cetera, and so forth, all those great leaders. But William Paul is the one who's the focus of the piece and really the stuff of drama. He led a very, very interesting life. So, yeah, that's Monday night.
Okay. Then Tuesday?
And Tuesday, we're doing a Filipino play called Flipsoids, which is about immigrants, Filipino immigrants adapting to America. And that play will later be produced by our friend Flordelino Lagandino and Generator Theater Company, which is his company, in April, the fully produced work. So this is a sneak peek at that play. It's terrific, and it's about the immigrant experience. So again, land, migration, identity are the themes of that play, and they're very common between those two.
Art, what's the relationship between Perseverance and Generator?
We collaborate a lot. We share a lot of artists. Flordelino is, you'll see him work on our stage or direct on our stage, and then Generator is his company. So good friends and often collaborators and also working independently as well. So,
Wednesday?
And then Wednesday, we're really excited about this one. Marcus Gardley, who's an African-American playwright, has written a play called The Road Weeps, The Well Runs Dry, which is about the Black Seminole experience. So it's set in the Black Seminole community in Oklahoma in the 1870s and 1880s. It's actually part of a trilogy about the whole Black Seminole experience. And there's a number of interesting mixed race relationships in there. And so identity and love is a really powerful part of that story. Marcus is a brilliant young writer. He worked with people that knew August Wilson and is considered maybe the heir to August Wilson as the voice of the African-American theater, like the next big thing. I think he's tremendous. His work is really poetic. It's really epic. It takes place on a broad scale. And sometimes, I think because we're in Alaska, perseverance does well to take on, you know, large subjects, epic subjects, even though our space is small. But our imaginations are large, and it just seems right up here.
Yeah.
I met Marcus a couple of years ago through a friend of ours at an organization called the LARC Play Development Center, which is a New York City-based organization that focuses on supporting writing in the American theater. And LARC has supported Marcus for a while, and they're doing a rolling world premiere together with four other theaters, including Perseverance, of The Road Weeps, The Well Runs Dry. So this coming fall in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Theater Center will do The Road Weeps, The Well Runs Dry with their African-American company. And then next spring in Minneapolis, Pillsbury House Theater will do another production of The Road Weeps, The Well Runs Dry. Ours will be sometime in the fall of 2013. And then the final final production of this rolling world premiere will be in Tampa, Florida in the spring of 2014. And we're really honored to be asked to participate.
We don't always see readings of plays. Could you kind of explain what folks can expect when they come in Wednesday night and Monday night for the two readings?
Yeah. They'll probably see, and Tuesday as well, they'll probably see the actors in simple probably blacks and music stands. They'll be reading the script, so they will have read through it a few times beforehand. In the case of the Defenders of Alaska Native Country, we've been working on it all week, so there'll be a fair amount of familiarity with the scene. But it's a great alternative to seeing a fully staged work, because it really puts the writing at the forefront, and it shows you how important, how much an actor can do with their voice and how important the words are to theater. So it's a nice way to do it. And most of these plays, actually all of these plays, you will be able to see sometime in the next couple of years fully staged. So great chance to see what the process is and what the difference is between what a production does and what just the words and
the
actors can bring.
Thursday?
Thursday we have a performance of A Raisin in the Sun.
But it comes with
usual time. It comes with a reception beforehand and a discussion afterwards. Marcus will be there, and the cast of A Raisin in the Sun, some of whom have had relationships with Marcus before, which is kind of great. Mm-hmm. And we'll be able to talk about, you know, really the full arc, because I think Marcus is the cutting edge of African-American writing, from Lorraine Hansberry, who broke trail, to now, to what we're doing now. So that should be great.
Yeah, and then you close all this up with a panel discussion on Friday.
That's right.
At UAS.
Yeah.
And who's on the panel?
So on the panel we have Ishmael Hope, Flordelino Lagandino, Marcus Gardley, and I just found out that we'll also have Ed Bourgeois from Anchorage, who runs something called the Alaska Native Playwrights Project at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. So he knows a great deal about Alaska Native writing right now in the state. Really terrific actor as well. So really great to have Ed joining us from Anchorage.
And who will moderate this panel?
We have a great moderator who will be there. Yeah. So we're excited about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And who is
and
that?
That's, I can't tell you quite yet.
Oh,
but
I see.
It'll be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to be surprised by the moderator.
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. And this panel discussion begins at 7. All of these events are at 7 o'clock,
That's right.
So Monday 7, Tuesday 7, et cetera.
That's right.
Okay, and this is March 19th through the 23rd. Is there a charge for the events? How does that work?
There's a $25 festival pass that includes a ticket to A Raisin in the Sun, which is a nice deal, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also possible to do it a la carte at $5 per reading.
Okay.
So the regular price
but for... But not raisin.
Right, exactly. The regular price for Thursday night is $20 with discounts for students and seniors. So,
so this is a discounted package.
Yeah, it's a pretty nice package. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And at this panel discussion now, the topic that the panel is going to work through is what?
Land, identity, and culture in the theater. Yeah.
Okay,
and
land, identity, and culture in the theater. Okay, so... I imagine then that since you're drawing people from each of the events through the week, that the discussion will probably highlight pieces of that and then look at how they kind of interact with one another.
Yeah, I think so. I think the threads between these plays are really interesting to look at, the Native American experience, the Alaska Native experience, the African American experience, and the Filipino experience. That'll be really interesting to see.
Or you ought to be able to earn a college credit for the
week. That's right. That's right.
It's like a mini course in an aspect of drama that could be pretty intensive if you went through the whole sequence.
Yeah.
How long the readings last? If people came at 7, what time would they expect to be?
I would expect to be out in most cases a little after 9.
Okay, so a couple hours.
Yeah, most of these plays are going to run a couple hours.
Where do you get tickets?
Tickets are available at perseverancetheater.org, at Hearthside Books, both locations, at the Juno Arts and Culture Center downtown, or you can call 463-TIXS and talk to us over the phone.
Art, this is an ambitious program, but it sounds like it is designed to really bring someone who sticks with it and goes through the process some real rewards in understanding an aspect of theater that doesn't really get played as much as the drama or the acting and that sort of thing.
I think it's a great chance to go deeper for people that want to.
And it's called the Landmarks Festival. Starts Monday night, 7 o'clock, and then 7 o'clock every night of the week, all at Perseverance until
Friday,
which is at the university, where we can run a panel discussion in more comfort and like that.
Yeah.
Terrific. Well, thank you very much for coming down and telling
us
about
this.
I hope people take advantage of it. A little Irish music here for the day, tomorrow. Irish music in honor of the day coming, which is tomorrow. I expect everybody to be wearing green for St. Patrick. He's a fine gentleman to be celebrating. So also coming up is the Shriners Ball with a band from Seattle. And with me in the studio are two folks from the band who are going to be playing. Let's see, what night's the concert?
It's actually St. Patrick's Day tomorrow night, Saturday night, March 17th.
And this is Lee Witt speaking.
I am Lee Witt, and I'm here with Christy Evans, who's a beautiful member of the band and a talented actress, comedian. And in fact, we might talk a little bit about later on. She just taped an NBC episode of Grimm, which is a new hit series on Friday nights there, and she's quite the little actress as well. So,
well, second the motion on beautiful, but then we'll have to deal with actress and comedian here as we go along. So are you going to tell us a joke? Or
actually, I did just hear a joke on the plane. I shouldn't tell it, though.
Yeah, this is National Public Radio.
Well,
yeah,
we'll give you a few moments to think of one that is appropriate for air as we go along through here. So Witt starts this band when he's 45 years old, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you join it at your young, gentle, and beautiful age. this is not an ordinary undertaking. Most bands start in the garage when you're 16, Lee. What happened here?
Well,
and I think that's the topic of your book as well, right?
Yeah, it's really, the book talks about the process we used to put this band together, because both Brooke, my wife, and I were in our late 40s when we began. And everybody said, well, you're too old, you don't have an agent, you don't have enough experience, you're full-time parents, you have full-time careers, you're out of your mind. And there's 800 bands vying for any 30 jobs in the Seattle area. And we just became completely unreasonable and got it done, and we've succeeded against the odds. And now we do get flown around the country, all over the place. And it's been a great privilege to do things like the Shriners Ball, because they do such fantastic work.
Let's talk briefly about the Shriners Ball, and then, Christy, I want to talk to you a little bit about singing with the band. The Shriners Ball is what time?
It's from 7 to midnight, and that's
okay.
Tomorrow, Saturday night, March 17th, and it's at Centennial Hall. And it's going to be as much fun as you can possibly have and still be legal. And, of course, 100% of the proceeds go to the Shriners Hospitals for Children. And they do such amazing work. There are 22 hospitals across the nation. And actually, there are 925,000 Alaskan children right now being treated. And many are actually not that many currently that have been. And a lot of the Alaskan children end up down in the Portland, Oregon hospital. And they handle burns, artificial limbs, hearing, vision. And, oh, my gosh, if you're ever going to contribute to anything, come out tomorrow night, because they do such wonderful work. And, oh, you just can't go wrong with the Shriners. Love them.
What's the suggested donation and or admission price? Do you happen to have it in front
of you? Yes, I do. The ticket prices are $30 per person or $50 per couple, and just $25 for students, seniors, and active military personnel. And you can get tickets at the door, and probably through tomorrow you can get them at Hearthside Books as well. So, and if you have any, you want to see more about it, you can go to www.junoshrinersball.org for more details.
So now to the lovely Christy. What kind of music does this band play?
Oh, my gosh.
I know he's the leader of the thing, but no, he can't lead anything unless you're doing the job there. So.
That's right.
No, well, I have to do it too. We do Andrew Sisters, we do Beyonce, we do Journey, we've done Metallica.
Oh, so no range
in the
at
past.
All.
No, we're pretty limited.
Yeah.
We do just about everything from rock to we do swing music, 40s, and everything, stuff that's on the radio today. It's ridiculous.
And just about every genre will hit before the course of the evening, so that everybody gets something that they enjoy, something to dance to.
And you can slow dance, too.
On your website, you refer to yourselves as a cover band.
Mm-hmm.
What are you covering?
Well, basically, a lot of the 70s disco, R&B, funk hits, the 80s rock, top 40 hits of the day. We can do the swing. So it's really a broad genre. We've probably done over 300 songs since we started mm-hmm. this 10 years ago. So, you know, everything from Sinatra to the Black Eyed Peas.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so, but we have 7 people in the band, and everybody has kind of a specialty. So we can go to the swing folks. We can go to the Beyonce folks. We can go to the Christina Aguilera folks. We can go to the, you know, Pink. And so it's really broad.
What's the instrumentation?
We have drums, bass, lead guitar, and I'm on keyboards. We also do something that really gives us a competitive advantage that the book talks about, called sequencing. And what this does is we can get a full orchestral sound by programming strings and horns that go through my top keyboard. And so we can do Earth, Wind, and Fire with the horns. We can do, but I don't have to pay the horn players. So the Shriners make more money.
I had a friend in Portland that played synth sax.
Yes, yes.
That's an amazing instrument.
Isn't
because
it?
Basically you kick your foot against a control and suddenly you're blowing an orchestra looks like a saxophone.
Oh, I know. It's amazing.
Yeah.
The technology is amazing.
It is. It is. So you use it primarily to get the band big and
let it gives a full sound, and really it's what's great is people come, they want to hear the songs that they recognize. They want to hear the songs they enjoy, and they want to hear them kind of like they recognize them. And so that gives us that ability to do that. And it's phenomenal when it really, when we watch it working and you're looking out, we got to play for 10,000 people at the Key Arena in Seattle last summer. And when it's overwhelming, when it's working and you're looking out at that, oh my gosh, it was incredible.
Lee, when you bring the band up here, do you bring the whole band? Is this the whole band?
Yes, we brought the whole band, and we brought our stellar sound guy, who we normally have an entire sound company travel with us. But we just brought our sound guy because much of the backline equipment is being provided here. But he's here to take care of us, and he knows what we need and what we have to have. And my comfort level is much higher whenever he's nearby. So, yeah.
So Christy, have you been up here before?
Yes, this is my third time.
Third time in last. So is Whit a taskmaster that will let you loose, or do you get to look around a little bit?
Oh, no, he lets us go. We saw the glacier once, and that's all he let us do. But
is that drive through and point out the window? That's it over there.
Yeah, and then he said, now get back in the hotel and start rehearsing.
Yeah, I figured he looked, I could tell from the whip that he brought in.
I would say, I think you're a taskmaster, but in the best sense possible.
Well, thank you.
He brings out the best in everybody while still letting us have some individual freedoms, just one or two.
So how did the NBC gig come about?
Through my agent, I had a talking to with her and said, I want to be involved in some of these shows that are featuring the Pacific Northwest, and because they shoot that show in Portland. And 2 weeks later, it happened, and I had an audition, and I had to go back for a callback, and then I got the part. So the
career is launched here. Huh?
Yeah, well, I'd like to think so. I mean, everything builds on everything else, so I hope so. It'll be exciting to see.
When will this episode air on NBC, do you know?
I'm guessing it'll be somewhere in the middle of April.
Okay.
I've been trying to figure out their programming schedule, and I can't. Their next new episode, I believe, is on the 30th, and then mine would be two episodes after that, so I'm guessing the middle of April.
Yeah. Oh. Okay, so people who hear and see you tomorrow night can maybe find out when that's coming up and say, I know her.
Yeah,
I knew her when she was in Juneau.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Cool. My daughter managed to get a bit part in a movie. Not a good movie, but I have a copy of it that I play every once in a while. She was in a crowd. So.
Aww. It's exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, I know.
It is. Isn't it?
Oh, it is. And Christy's being very modest as well. She's really well known in the Seattle area as a talented improv comedian. And she's done work, gosh, in most of the venues and theaters there, and she's just a delight and an amazing talent. So if you want to come out and see this fantastic woman tomorrow night, oh, I'm telling you, she's worth the price.
let me go back now to your book. You this thing's for sale, I would imagine.
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the retail outlets.
Okay. The title is?
It's called The Brick House Band, How an Ordinary Midlife Couple Created a Business Phenomenon.
Okay.
And it really outlines what we call the always advanced performance methodology. And it's a way of approaching any entrepreneurial endeavor. It doesn't have to be a band, but anything that you're putting together from scratch, if you follow these steps and you just don't stop, you'll get there.
Yeah. And you do motivational speaking? And
I do. I'm very fortunate. I get out to talk to a lot of different companies that bring me out, and it's very gratifying because I really feel like I'm making probably more of an impact in that way than just making people happy playing music.
Yeah.
But we're changing lives, and it's fantastic when you see people actually get a message and they implement what you've told them, and you go, wow, they really listened. And I hear back, and they're successful, and it's terrific.
When you do those gigs, is that a solo gig for you, or do you bring the band along?
Occasionally, we actually will do like full days for corporations and hotels, where in the morning we'll give them a little exercise class and a dance class.
Uh-huh.
We'll give them some a seminar in the afternoon and play their dinner in the evening. And so they can get a full day of the Brick House Band if they want. And it really works out well for companies because they can just go to one hotel, have everything taken care of, and we'll see that it's all perfect for them.
Fascinating. Okay. So you brought along a chunk of music.
Yes.
We're going to see if maybe we can make the technology work here. Not quite. Don't push the button just quite yet.
Okay.
But I want to make sure that we put in the times and everything one more time. The dance is?
It's tomorrow night, the 17th, St. Patrick's Day at Centennial Hall from 7 to midnight. All the proceeds go to the Shriners, and I'm telling you what, it's going to be fantastic. If you're not doing anything else tomorrow night, come to Centennial Hall.
Good enough. So here's a sample of the band, I'm hoping. It's not coming through the board, so hold it up to the microphone. There we go. We got it. It was just that cable. Well, we had a little technical difficulty there. We were actually trying to pull a segment that the band had recorded off of an iPhone and play it for you, and it's just not going to work for us. So you'll have to go to the thing and listen to the Brick House Band in order to hear them play tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. Tickets available at the door and around town in the usual places.
Yeah.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 16th of March, 2012. Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter was published on this day, 1850, an instant bestseller, 2,500 copies sold in 10 days. It was one of the first mass-produced books in America, distributed quickly, so more people were reading it at once, talking about it, which drove sales. The second edition of 1,500 copies sold out in just 3 days. It was on this day, 1926, Robert Goddard launched the first liquid-fueled rocket. Growing up in Worcester, Massachusetts, as a boy, he read H.G. Wells's The War of the Worlds and imagined how wonderful it would be to make some device which had even the possibility of ascending to Mars. Years later, studying at the Worcester Polytechnic Institute, he made a rocket that was powered by gunpowder, and he came up with a theory that a rocket engine could produce thrust even in the vacuum of space without any air to thrust against. The government was not interested in the idea of space travel, so he had a hard time getting grants for his research, paid for most of it himself. Finally, a grant from the Smithsonian Institution enabled him to do research and publish a paper on a method for reaching extreme altitudes. In the paper, he speculated that rockets could be used to reach the moon. The New York Times heard about it, ridiculed him, but he persisted. And on this date in 1926, he completed the first successful launch of his liquid-fueled rocket in Auburn, Massachusetts. It burned gasoline, liquid oxygen. It went up 41 feet in the air. And his wife Esther's movie camera ran out of film, so there was no record of the launch. It's the birthday of Alice Hoffman, born New York City, 1952, raised on Long Island by her single mother, wrote her first novel, Property Of, at 21. She writes for young adults as well as older ones. Most recent novel, The Dove Keepers, came out last fall. And it's the birthday of Sid Fleischman, born Brooklyn, 1920, grew up in San Diego, wanted to be a magician, toured with vaudeville acts, became a journalist, then wrote suspense novels. And one day his daughter Jane came home from school with the autograph of a children's author. Fleischman's wife pointed out to the kids that their father was also a writer, and Jane said, "Yes, but no one reads his books." So he started in to write for children. He wrote Mr. Mysterious and Company, and he wrote The Whipping Boy, about a European prince whose servant, the whipping boy, has to get the prince's punishments because it's a crime to strike the prince, and a memoir, The Abracadabra Kid, A Writer's Life. Here's a poem for today by Marie Howe, entitled Prayer. Every day I want to speak with you, and every day something more important calls for my attention, the drugstore, the beauty products, the luggage I need to buy for the trip. Even now I can hardly sit here, among the falling piles of paper and clothing, the garbage trucks outside already screeching and banging. The mystics say you are as close as my own breath. Why do I flee from you? My days and nights pour through me like complaints and become a story I forgot to tell. Help me. Even as I write these words, I am planning to rise from the chair as soon as I finish this sentence. Prayer by Marie Howe. From The Kingdom of Ordinary Time, published by W.W. Norton & Company, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. Written by Holly Vanderhaar, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 28 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. My guest now is a really accomplished wildlife photographer, Jaylene Beadle, who is going to talk tonight at the Fireside Chats out at the Glacier Visitors Center. This is a regular 6:30 and 8 o'clock program that's been held for a long time. I found out when the ranger came in on the show. I guess they've been doing these things since the Glacier Visitors Center was built. And I got an interesting email from the lady who is in charge of the Visitors Center. I've been inviting people each time I interviewed someone on these Fridays to come and sit next to the crackling fire and all that. It turns out that because of the size of the crowds, they've had to move it into the theater. So nobody, you can actually sit next to the electric crackling fire. It's no longer a log fire. And there is a monitor up in the area that you can watch it on. Or you can go into the theater and see the person presenting live with the big screen, which, as I understand it, would be a real good idea tonight because Jaylene's photography is going to be part of the presentation. And she is, from what she's been posting out on the Internet, she's quite accomplished with the camera. Jaylene, the topic of your talk is about living off the grid.
Yes, it's about, my dad's actually going to do the first section on how we got into alternative energies and what systems we're running out there right now. And then the second part of the show is going to be myself talking about just how it was living with alternative energies and living remote on an island through a kid's eyes, how it was to grow up out there living like that.
So, obviously, you moved out there when you were 10, you were telling me?
Yeah, consecutively, we've been out there for 9 years, but right. We lived out there briefly for a year when I was 6.
Okay. And so you must have a different set of childhood memories than people who you might have compared them to. Did you go to school correspondence or?
I was homeschooled.
Okay.
For all the years that we lived out on the island. The years in between, though, I did go to public school, so I've had a little bit of both.
Okay. So have you had a chance to compare the way your growing to young adulthood went in that to other people that you might know?
Yeah, actually. I think one of the biggest differences was I was originally forced to just spend a lot of time with my family. They were the only people that I really could spend a lot of time with out on the island. And I feel like kids nowadays are spending less and less time with their family just because of social networking and how busy their lives become. And that, I think, is the biggest difference between.
Did you get a TV signal out there?
No, we probably could have, but we don't have cable at all, no.
But chose not to, huh? So.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, all right. So what does an evening look like then when you don't have TV and you don't have the Internet and you don't have all of those distractions?
Well, my whole family were avid readers, so we read a lot. But when the generator's on, if we've just been to town, Mom will have picked up the new movies that just came out on DVD, so we'll watch them. Or we got a Wii a couple years ago, and so we're big fans of Mario Kart racing and all that stuff.
But so you're not anti-technology here?
No, not at all. Okay. It would be impossible to be anti-technology just by homeschooling. I mean, we rely on our computers and internet a lot, but it's definitely not first in our lives, I guess.
How much local eating can you do in the island? Do you bring everything in by boat and it's all out of cans? Or do you do a lot of local, did you grow a big garden or something?
We do have a garden in the summertime. In the wintertime, we are only able to get into town maybe once every couple weeks when the weather works out. So we do have a very large pantry where we keep all our canned foods and stuff. And we keep those for backup, but we usually try to just keep, you know, extra bread, extra milk. Organic milk lasts longer than non-organic milk. You know, we've just figured this stuff out through the years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that we haven't run out of, like, greens or bread or all that stuff before, but it doesn't happen too often.
So can you describe your alternative kitchen? I'm just curious. Do you have all the appliances that I would expect? You're using electricity, right? How are you generating it?
We do have electricity. We have a 12-unit battery bank and a generator that's hooked into that.
Okay.
We don't use the generator as much as we used to because we have 14 solar panels and 2 wind generators now. Between those two, we're able to pretty much keep it up so we don't have to run the generator as much. Our kitchen, we have a very small propane fridge with a small propane freezer right above it. We have a propane stove. We have a toaster, you know, but the toaster's tricky because you have to wake up in the morning early enough while the generator's running so that you can toast your toast, or else if you miss the generator, then you can't have toast.
Then you don't get toast.
No, until that night when the generator's turned on again.
What do you heat with?
We heat with wood. So we got a wood stove in the middle of our house, and it's able to heat it well.
Okay, and who cuts? Who does the good wood fires always warm twice? Who gets the first warming?
Dad.
Is that Jaylene's job?
Dad will cut and split the wood.
Oh, okay.
And Jason and I help stack it. But the common punishment for my brother and I when we got in trouble was we'd have to go haul wood from the wood stack to the front porch, and so that was always.
How could you get in trouble and living on an island without all of those distractions to?
Oh, there are ways. Trust me.
I won't ask you to describe any of them, but so you could get grounded or mm-hmm. Or catch an extra chore. Or something.
Yes.
Do you feel like you're? How do you feel about your preparation for the world? I mean, you were homeschooled in a remote location, off the grid. The rest of the world didn't grow up like you do. How do you feel about it?
Well, although I grew up on a remote island, my family ran a whale watching business, and I worked as a naturalist on board the whale watching boats for many years.
Ah.
And so for me, I got my people skills through that. I was able to expand and meet other people and to learn how to interact with people. I feel like it would have been really hard to get used to interacting with people. Not because our parents kept us locked out on the island, just because there's just not a lot of opportunity to interact with people. And so I guess homeschooling really prepares you to be independent-minded, to be motivated, to get what you want done. But I feel like it still is lacking that people skills, usually.
So what would you say is your boredom quotient when you're living out like that?
My boredom quotient?
On a scale of 1 to 10, how many days are boring and how many, I mean, is boredom a problem?
Boredom is, I wouldn't necessarily call it boredom.
I take this from something you said on your blog. There was a point where you were talking about the fact that you had gone on a kind of an expedition with your uncles and your dad, and that it was really good to get out of the house for a change.
Yes.
And the way I read that, it sounded like you're stuck in the house a lot and probably bored some.
I was probably in the winter, and I wouldn't call it so much boredom as on the verge of cabin fever. You just, like, there's always something to do. We're always staying busy with, like, homeschooling and just we keep busy. But it gets tiring because you're doing the same thing day after day after day. And so I would say that after a couple weeks, I have to get out of the house. I have to go do something. I can't stay and do the same thing for one more day. And so I think that's what I was talking about on my blog, was it was just good to have a change in pace.
Well, Jaylene, we'll hear both you and your dad tonight talking mm-hmm. about alternative energy. The shows are at 6:30 and at 8 o'clock. It's the same program, but it's repeated so that people who get off work and want to go out or up to the early one, or who want to go home and do a little family life and then come out to the 8. And once again, we do not all sit around the fire toasting our toes with the coals. Basically, it's in an auditorium where we can see your wonderful pictures, and I imagine your dad has some excellent visuals as well of the alternative energy setup. And here's a chance to learn how someone has built an alternative energy lifestyle. Where's your place?
It's located on the southwest side of Shelter.
Oh, okay, so out on Shelter Island. Okay, good. Well, thank you very much for coming down, and thank you very much for are you coming into town for this? Are you here for
I live here in town now because I'm a full-time student at UAS.
Oh, okay.
But my dad is in town now for it.
What are you majoring in?
Photojournalism.
Photojournalism, wonderful. Yeah. Well, you're sure doing you have a great beginning to the process, let me tell you. Thank you very much. A little more Irish music here in honor of the day. Thank you. a fine old Irish song by Bron Journey here, performed on the harp. He's a Seattle area harpist. You might have run into him. I think he plays out at the airport every once in a while. I hope that's the right guy that I'm thinking of. So it's about 10 minutes before, well, it's about 9 minutes before four, and my guest is going to talk to us about a bereavement support group that is coming up with Dr. Elaine Schrader. We had Dr. Schrader on the show a couple of months ago when one of these started, I think, here in town, and she said then that we should have someone come in and tell us about the next one for people that might be interested. So tell us, Lori Dameron, about the upcoming workshop.
Well, the workshop starts on Tuesday evening. It will be running for 8 weeks, and it is a support group for any individuals who have suffered a bereavement or loss and are having some trouble coping with it. We generally try to have folks who are, you know, haven't lost somebody immediately, you know, in the very recent past, because their emotions may still be a little raw. But often folks find that it's helpful to talk to other people as they're on this grief journey and, you know, to be around other people who understand exactly what they're going through.
And Elaine leads these workshops because she's qualified how?
Well, she is a social worker and also a psychologist, doctor of psychology, and she really enjoys working on grief work with people and helping folks along that journey.
I think the old model that there are some stages of grief or something like that has now pretty much been sort of slid away. We know now that it's not quite the mechanistic process that sort of seems to describe.
Right.
Everybody's path to coming back after a grief-causing episode is a differently traveled road.
Right.
It was something that I got from that interview when mm-hmm. Elaine was here. And mm-hmm. so I think the big utility that she talked about then is the fact that by being around other people, you discover, as is often the case, that there's somebody else who feels the same horrible way that you're feeling when you get up in the morning
mm-hmm.
and right. like that. So
and the things they've done to keep going, you can sometimes learn some coping strategies from each other or just having some place to share how profoundly you hurt
yeah.
can be helpful.
Yeah. Where will these sessions be held?
They will be held at the Bridge Adult Day, which is 1803 Glacier Highway,
okay.
And which is halfway between the hospital and downtown.
Yeah, it's big. You can see the building from the new highway when you're
mm-hmm.
looking up the hill there. Right. And there's a cost associated with this, right?
That's right. It's an $80 suggested donation. But if people are having trouble financially, there are definitely scholarships.
When you say donation, whom are they donating to?
The donation is to hospice and home care. We
okay.
are the sponsoring agency.
And so hospice and home care would use this money for?
To support our programs, to make sure that we are able to provide services to people who need them, no matter what their ability to pay is.
So hospice and home care now has a broader mission than the usual single mission hospice
right,
group.
Right.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
I can try. so hospice is the end of life care
yeah.
and trying to make sure that people can die with dignity and comfort in their home and surrounded by their family and with their family getting the support they need to be successful at this caregiving. The home care aspect is more for folks who've had an event such as a hip fracture or a stroke or something like that they are anticipated to recover from, and it's a chance for us to go in there with nursing and therapies, and I'm the social worker, to help them get better. Now, sometimes folks kind of fall between the two, so the lines are not always perfectly clear, or somebody enters one program and goes into the other,
mm-hmm.
Because sometimes people do so well even when we've admitted them in hospice care that they're still around and they don't really quite qualify for hospice anymore. So mm-hmm. then we keep them as a home care client if they still need that. So.
How is home care paid for?
Home care is paid for with Medicare or Medicaid or VA. Pretty much the insurances cover it.
Okay. And so it's kind of between you and your insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
People now have long-term care insurance policies. Do you know if any part of that can be applied to home care? It's probably not a question that I should be asking you. I'm putting you on the spot.
I am not certain, but I do believe that it can be. Don't hold me to this. We have financial people who luckily pay attention to that. What I do know about long-term care insurance is that usually people have to have their services in place for like 90 days before you can start tapping into that insurance.
Okay. So Elaine's group is going to begin meeting on Tuesday, March 20th, mm-hmm. 6:30 p.m. Mm-hmm. They'll be at the Bridge Adult Daycare Center, but you have to pre-register if you want to take advantage of it.
Yes.
How does someone do that?
They call me or they email to me. And my phone number, my direct line is 463-6109. And my email address is Laura, L-A-U-R-A, dot Dameron, D-A-M-E-R-O-N, at ccsjuno.org.
And is that like an 8 to 5 contact? Well, the email, of course, anytime. But
the email anytime, and I am a part-time employee, but I'll be monitoring those closely. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How many people will you accept for the group?
I think we're aiming for 8 to 12.
Okay.
So.
Okay. So if this is a something that's attractive to you, you want to contact Lori Dameron at Laura Dameron at Laura, L-A-U-R-A dot D-A-M-E-R-O-N at ccsjuno.org, and the telephone number is 463-6109. The group starts on Tuesday. So, thank you very much for coming down and alerting people to the start of the group. Monday, Jeff will be back as host, and he'll be talking with Beth Weigel and Christina Moore about this Friday's Discovery Day, next Friday's Discovery Day. Tom Matisse will come in to discuss a presentation Monday night on the Urban Avalanche Mitigation Study. Mandy O'Neill Cole from AWARE will drop in with a preview of Wednesday's Brown Bag Session on Homelessness and Domestic Violence. And Liz Perry and Linda Ballard will be talking about planning for Celebration 2012. He'll have bird note music. Writer's Almanac and more. That'll all be on Monday at 3 on KTOO, which is heard throughout Juneau on 104.3 FM. We also translate our signal so that you can hear it more plainly in the Valley and Auk Bay area. We're on 103.1 MHz at K276 AF. Our translator call sign is K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek. It's on 101.7. Gustavus is on 88.1 at K201 AM. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, we're on K210AS at 89.9.